Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When Jane Addams opened Hull House in Chicago in the 1890s, she envisioned a system of neighbors helping neighbors with education, meals, culture, and childcare under one roof. It wasn't considered charity. And that vision laid the groundwork for what would become the field of social work. Since then, social workers have railed against social injustices while also caring for the neediest and most vulnerable in society. The pandemic has exacerbated the need in hospitals and nursing homes for people who are homeless and increasingly among the ranks of law enforcement. Angela McLean is the chief executive officer of the Washington, D.C.-based National Association of Social Workers. It's the largest association of professional social workers with about 115,000 members. Welcome to the show, Angela.
Good morning. Thank you, Ann, for having me. Appreciate it.
You know, social work is already a high-stress job. We've heard about it for years. It sees a lot of turnover in the best of times, I suppose, whatever we want to define those as these days. But how does it look these days?
Social work in the best of times is a great profession. I always say for every one sort of really hard, difficult case, you've got 40 or 50 that really go well, that are inspiring. In these times, it's been hard on folks because just like in the community, you want to help as many people as possible. And it takes a toll on you, your family. And it's hard because people are, you know, some social workers have contracted COVID and recovered and then gone right back to work. So it's hard, but it's rewarding work.
I think of social work as a people person job, somebody who likes to be around people. And I imagine one of the issues that they're facing, like all of the rest of us, is the distancing issue. How's that affecting the profession?
You know, on the one hand, we're so pleased that we were able to get, you know, telehealth approved through CMS and Congress, and that we also were able to get audio-only telehealth approved because many of our clients, you know, don't have wideband and internet and so forth. So on the one hand, it's as you say, it's a relationship face-to-face kind of thing. But on the other hand, we're so thankful that we can stay connected with the families and clients through technology. And actually sort of our no-show rates have been going down because, you know, people don't have to transport and those kind of things. Right. They can just get right on the phone or right on the Zoom link and have that session.
Yeah, I'm hearing that from a lot of people in a lot of different professions. You know, I have social workers in my family, so I maybe make the assumption that everybody understands what they do. And the fact is they do so many things that I've only learned about over many years. Can you give us sort of the thumbnail of what a social worker is and what their mission is and what they do?
Well, our mission is to help improve the quality of life for everyone in society. People often think of social workers, you know, helping people who are experiencing difficulties, struggles, problems, but that's a lot of what we do at an individual and a family level, but we also work to make sure that we have things in place at a societal level, you know, things like a Civil Rights Act, the Social Security, a lot of the labor laws were championed by social workers.
What are you hearing from your members? What are their big issues right now?
You know, with the surge in the pandemic, it's sort of reliving the spring all over again. You know, people concerned about, you know, quarantining. You know, some folks aren't going home. You know, they're checking in the hotel because they're concerned that they don't want to give it to their family members. People having more cases to try to track down than, you know, for instance, think of a school social worker and a child being, you know, absent, you know, those social workers will find that child and find that family. And then when you think of the number of admissions going up, well, that means the number of discharges on the back end go up, and social workers are the ones working to make those connections to get people back home, back into the community, and have the social services that they need to be able to reintegrate back into society. And then they're doing all that work, the grief work, with those families who lost a loved one.
How big a part of a social worker's job is counseling?
Yeah, a big part is there are about 200,000 clinical social workers in the country, maybe a little bit more. and obviously they're therapists and they do that kind of work, but every social worker who's seen families and working communities is doing a lot of counseling, a lot of, you know, helping people see the strength within themselves to be able to have a better life.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And we're talking about the role of social workers today, not just with the within the context of the pandemic, but also the social justice movement and how that's playing a role in their jobs. My guest for the hour is Angelo McLean. He is the chief executive officer of the National Association of Social Workers. That's the largest association of professional social workers with about 115,000 members. And it's based out of Washington, D.C. If you have a question or comment this hour about social work, if you're a social worker, you know, on the front lines, whether it's the social justice movement, whether it's the pandemic, whether it's all the other issues that are sort of tied up between them, give us a call. Tell us about your tell us your story. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Angelo McLean, are there enough social workers out there?
I mean, yes and no. It's sort of the profession has grown about 16% over the last 10 years and expected to grow another 16% through 2026, 2028. There are roughly about 750,000 social workers. We have one of the fastest rates of growth in number of folks in the profession compared to other professions. At one point, the Bureau of Labor Statistics was predicting by 2022 we would have a shortage of social workers, but enrollment in schools has been up over the last, you know, 10 years or so. But we keep finding more things for social workers to do. And You know, we're in child welfare, mental health, hospital social work. Folks may not realize it, but there's actually something called police social work, where we have a number of social workers working in police departments, and then social workers in business. So the social work process, social work solutions, keep addressing more and more of society's concerns.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have become aware of the issue of social work and policing in recent months. It's become a topic of conversation, but they have been working with some police departments for a while now, right?
Yeah, the term police social work was first coined back in, I think, 1953. And, yeah, I counted at one point there were probably 50 different jurisdictions who had social workers working within police departments. I should be real clear that social workers aren't working under law enforcement, but working with law enforcement and do things to create diversions. You know, say if someone has a mental health issue and they're about to be go to jail or be incarcerated, we can actually come up with a solution that can help prevent that. Or if a person needs mental health services, whether it's outpatient or inpatient psychiatric, we're there to help with that. And oftentimes, you know, social workers are the second responders. As a child welfare commissioner in Massachusetts, I used to go out on ride-alongs with law enforcement so I could help the staff figure how we fit with law enforcement. And it's somewhat of a natural fit. You know, obviously law enforcement first responds, but then you got to hand it off to someone who can help sort out all the social issues.
I was reading a column from August by Lori James Towns. It was in Slate.com about her assertion that social workers cannot work with police. And she said that there's a growing national consensus coalescing around the importance of social work and skilled crisis intervention as alternatives to policing. And she said that makes sense. She said, but many, including the National Association of Social Workers, are suggesting a dangerous middle ground that social workers should work hand in hand with police in response to medical health crises. Do you see a distinction there?
Yeah, there's a distinction there. You know, I spent 20 years of my career working in child welfare, and in child welfare, you know, child protective services, we relied heavily on the police, and they always had our back. And I've talked to social workers who worked in law enforcement. I'm thinking of a social worker in Michigan who worked on the sex trauma team for 27 years. So there's a lot of work that we can do internal to police departments to reform police departments. And then there's a lot of work that we need to do to reform police departments as external. And that's where some of our advocacy and policy work comes in. And in some communities, there's a consideration of rather than having social workers in the police departments, why not create a department of community public safety like they're doing in Albuquerque? And then, you know, whether you're working alongside in the same department or working alongside from a different department, it's how do you complement the skills of law enforcement and social work? And how can you eventually have less and less policing in our lives and communities, and where we can be addressing some of these issues upstream? Because we know a lot of these, by the time the police have to intervene, that means our preventative measures have failed.
There is a unit in the Columbus Division of Police that kind of, you know, they look for keywords and calls, and if it, if there's a mental health component to it, that automatically, for lack of a better word, triggers, you know, contacting that team and having them go out, and then a social worker is going out with an officer.
Yeah, that sounds like a good partnership. You go out and I've been in those situations where police make a pretty quick assessment, and within 2 minutes, the social worker is taking the lead, and then the police kind of, you know, step into the background and eventually get in their patrol car and drive off. So it can work. And particularly, you know, one of the things we've talked about is rather than trying to say model A or model B is the preferred model, is it's going to vary community to community, and the people in the community need to be engaged and talk to about, okay, what do you want from your policing? In some communities, they want more policing. In other communities, they want less. And it's going to be the community that is going to make it work, whatever direction a community goes in. But we all know that we want to eradicate oppressive policing. We want to eradicate police brutality. And we, the taxpayers, are paying their salaries, and we want to be protected and respected. I had an encounter the other day. I was walking, the gym's closed. I'm walking up and down the hill to get some exercise, and it was dark. And an officer pulled up and said, what are you doing? And I said, gym's closed. I'm trying to get some exercise. But he engaged me in a way that was respectful, and it was over with. But that could have been a situation if it was not engaged that way, it could have went sideways. And I was conscious of that I walked back home and told my wife, and she says, well, I knew something like that might happen. It was kind of late, and now at 4:30 it gets dark. So,
right.
It gets late early, but engaged respectfully and as a full a citizen who's got full rights.
We are talking about social work this hour. My guest is Angelo McLean. He is Chief Executive Officer of the National Association of Social Workers. It's the largest association of professional social workers. It's based in Washington, D.C. There's about 115,000 members. We want to hear your stories or your questions this hour, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Joining us coming up, we're going to be hearing from the Dean of the College of Social Work at Ohio State about what they're teaching social workers these days and how that curriculum might be changing. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Professor Kinstrom at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in August surveyed more than 600 social workers around the world. She found strikingly similar pandemic-related worries, including the logistics of staying connected with clients. We're talking about the role of social workers during the twin challenges of the pandemic and the social justice movement in the United States. Still with us, Angela McLean, Chief Executive Officer of the National Association of Social Workers. Joining us, Tom Gregoire. He is Dean of the College of Social Work at Ohio State. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here and happy holidays.
Thank you. Happy holidays to you. Morgan Springsteen is a licensed social worker and care coordinator at the University of Cincinnati Medical Center, where she works directly with COVID patients. Welcome to the show, Morgan.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So what does your day look like these days?
Well, it's definitely a little bit different than about a year ago. But a lot of conversations over the phone, a lot of planning for what life is going to look like after discharge, and kind of just working with patients and families, providing support and encouragement during this extremely difficult time to be a patient in a hospital.
I mean, hypothetically, you're finding you're coming in contact with the patients when they're getting ready to be discharged, right?
Yes, yes. We begin discharge planning kind of at the beginning of the hospital stay, but more towards the end as well. I get more involved.
And how does that differ now with a COVID patient than it would have with your, I don't know, your garden variety hospital discharge back in the day?
Yeah, so there's definitely a lot of fear around being discharged from the hospital, as well as fear of staying in here longer, as there's always risks of contracting something else while you're here. But there's also a lot of fear of if you're recommended for a skilled nursing facility or to go to some sort of rehab. With the visitation policies and restrictions, a lot of people are afraid of leaving the hospital and not being able to see their family for an extended period of time.
Tom Gregoire, the College of Social Workers had to pivot online like the rest of the university and all of that. But I'm more wondering about how what we're learning from the pandemic, I guess, and they call it the twindemic for social workers, the pandemic and the social justice movement, which I don't like to think of as an illness, but maybe a cure for some things. But in any event, a lot of the questions I ask people in all different kinds of professions over the last 9 months is, how has this changed your job in a more permanent way? What are the long-term impacts of this period of time on your profession?
I think both of these things are great amplifiers. They are just making much more obvious and much more present to us the systemic problems that we already had, and the challenges that we had in society with serving people are just made much greater in this regard. For us, we first have to think about safety for our students and safety for the people they serve and work with. But we also have to think about how to practice in a different context. And I don't think that has to be bad. If you think about the traditional helping relationship, you came to me most of the time when I was there, and we did work, and we're moving people more into doing virtual work and online work. And we all know that people have very meaningful virtual lives. And so we need to go and work in that space as well too. So lots of changes that begin just with self-care. But as I said to Morgan earlier, we don't think we're ever going back to the way things were. We use the term going back to the future, and there can be a lot of changes in the profession.
What do you think, Morgan?
No, I agree with that. I mean, we were just talking earlier about just it's been very different than it was before, and we'll see kind of just the long-term impacts, and just it's been really hard for patients and families not being able to see each other in person. And I can see obviously the effects here firsthand of different visitor restrictions when I am working with patients who have COVID, and just the impact that it has and kind of the ways we're able to help through iPad calls and video calls and helping them stay connected. And luckily we have outstanding nurses here who are able to help foster those connections and provide support when you're not able to have family members in person here.
Yeah, and Angela McLean, what do you think about what kind of long-term changes this has all brought about?
It's gonna accelerate our integration of technology. You know, some of us who were slow to move towards the telehealth can now see how we can integrate it into the work we do. It's, you know, in terms of social justice and racial justice, it's going to accelerate our fully embracing anti oppression-informed practices. There's, when we saw those horrible images of Memorial Day, my first sort of thought was, I hope this isn't another groundhog moment. You know, I hope this is actually a tipping point where we actually will just stay honed in on this. And it really seems to have been a tipping point where, particularly across the profession, where, there's more conversations of saying, as a profession, we have to own our contribution, our perpetuation of racism. We've got to, take that apart from an individual, organizational, and professional level. And people are actually doing that work and looking to say, how can we practice that's more relationship built? How can we practice that's more sort of constantly cognizant of oppression and institutions and systems that don't work for people?
You know, we just heard that story. I apologize, I can't remember, but she was an African-American physician who, before she died of COVID, was telling people, I'm being basically she was being mistreated because of her race. And, Tom Gregoire and Angelo McLean, you've both written about that, the pandemic and the racism pandemic. And I'm wondering what the role of the College of Social Work and the people that you train, Tom Gregoire, play in changing a dynamic like that. Was it real time we were learning from a physician about what's going on?
Yeah, that's a horrifying story. I read that as well. Angelo's point is right on. The inquiry has to begin at home. Our profession, we've always prepared people who go change the rules of the game for those who aren't doing as well in society. My whole profession exists because the status quo is harmful to a lot of people in our country. But we can't invite the rest of society to consider their impact on systemic oppression unless we do it first. So we've been having conversations in our community and in our curriculum and explore our role as a profession in perpetuating practices that harm people.
And Morgan Springsteen, there in the front lines like you are, where are you seeing any change at this point? Or is it too hard to change when you're, skating on the ice at the same time?
Yeah, I think that's a little bit harder for me to speak to, just as right now with the rising numbers in cases and the increase in COVID patients in our specific hospital, it's kind of just like you said, skating by, trying to do the best that we can to serve the patients that we're working with and get them the aftercare and follow-up that they need and are agreeable to.
Let's see. Aaron in Columbus, you're on the air on 89.7 NPR News. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. I was calling in to ask a question about formulating positions on how social workers interact with police, and how are the voices of communities who have been harmed by police violence incorporated into that decision-making?
Who can take on that one?
Speaking to that earlier, and the importance when we're considering reforming policing, and we definitely need to reform policing, is that the community leaders and the average citizens in the community be part of that discussion, part of that decision-making, and at the table, and really can say, here's what will work in our community, here's what's not worked, and be listened to when they tell their stories. And so many of people of color have told stories over the years about negative interactions with law enforcement, and we're not believed. And then folks who, we spend so much time trying to convince people that this actually did happen, and this has got to stop. And so just a belief but that voice is going to be really important in terms of establishing what the policy needs to be, helping implement the policy, evaluating the policy's effectiveness, and then adjusting the policy as it go forward. Because, there's no sort of program you can put on the ground and be 100% day one. It's going to have to be worked over time. And then having citizens part of the review boards. So as you're evaluating a program, the citizens are right there and they can bring firsthand stories to the discussion.
Aaron, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. Social worker Jared Bernstein serves on the President-elect Biden's Council of Economic Advisors, and he said that economists should work as social workers before crafting economic policies. And Morgan Springsteen, I want to ask you that first. what do you think about policies out there and how they're developed and whether they make sense at the ground level anymore?
I think that would be a very good suggestion for everyone to have to do that first. I mean, I have learned more doing this job and working in this field firsthand with people from, obviously we work with people in some of the most difficult times of their lives. And I think that that would be extremely important to have more firsthand experience and just to learn from the experiences of others when you're making those policies and procedures and really taking their experiences into account.
And Tom Gregoire, what about you at the teaching, you know, at the university level?
Yeah, I think that's really important. I told somebody once in another discipline that our students are looking for places to park their cars where your students wouldn't go in the middle of the day. You have to see how your policies affect people. You have to go out in the street and see what the impact is for folks and listen to the people you're legislating over.
But Angelo, where you're at in Washington, D.C., do you have any hopes that that's really ever going to that necessarily will happen? Or is having someone like Jared Bernstein a start?
It's a good start. You know, as you're asking that question about economics and people, I had two thoughts. You know, one is Representative Barbara Lee said to me many times, every member of Congress needs to read the NESW Code of Ethics. And if they read that Code of Ethics and followed the values and principles therein, we'd have a better country. She said that to me again about 2 months ago. So I committed to her that I'm going to make sure next month that every member of Congress gets a copy of the NESW Code of Ethics. The other thing I thought about when you're talking about the economic question was I thought about the Poor People's Campaign and the work that Reverend Barber and others are doing. Of, you know, we don't talk enough about poor people and lifting poor people up in our country. We often talk about the middle class and the working class, but, you know, economic policies that, you know, we know that policy's working if it's lifting up the poorest among us. And we've gotten to where we won't even use the word poor. We'll say low income, we'll say other things, but, you know, if the policy doesn't work for the poorest among us, it's not a good economic policy.
The your organization supported the $900 billion relief package that is, I guess, been signed into law. What do you like about the bill? And what, you know, I guess we only have time for high points, but what do you like about it? And what do you think has been left out?
That bill should have been passed back in September. We should have been getting relief much sooner. The $600 is inadequate. There's a lot of things we like about it in terms of relief, you know, unemployment, you know, more coverage that should have been extended. I mean, what about this? What about that? The help for small businesses, you know, we like that. The moratorium on eviction. So there's things we like, but it's kind of like this is a start, and we need to get another package passed quickly, and really targeting, you know, folks who've been impacted the most.
You know, Morgan Springsteen, I'm wondering for you at this point. I mean, we're going to probably have another surge after the holiday. And there's going to be a surge. I think of almost as like a tsunami. And Tom Gregoire, I'm interested in your thoughts, too, is how when it comes to the poverty issue, because of what the pandemic has done to the economy. Now, not the economy writ large. For wealthy people, they're fine. For middle class people, many of them are OK. It's for the poor people. It's even worse. Are you feeling that where you're at right now, Morgan?
Definitely. I mean, we are the number one trauma center, level one trauma center in the city. We have a very diverse population of patients that we work with. I mean, I help people on regularly trying to get their power back on because they've lost their job because of the pandemic and they can't use the medical equipment that they need because they don't have power. And so it's making phone calls to the utility companies and trying to work with landlords to see kind of what we can do. But obviously, I can only work with patients while they're here. And so not able to make as much impact as I'd like to, but I can definitely see the effects firsthand of the families and patients that are being impacted by the loss of jobs and the pandemic.
And Tom Gregoire, I'm wondering, I mean, this is not going to get better. It's going to get worse before it gets better, right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I'm frightened. Frightened for when the addiction or eviction dam breaks and we are putting people on the streets. I'm frightened for that. There's not going to be enough to eat in this country, which is always really, frankly, disgusting that such a wealthy country has so many hungry people. Mm-hmm. I saw data recently that because of the pandemic, there are 54 million people, 18 million children that are food insecure. That should horrify all of us. You know, and Angelo's point about just $600, the best thing about that is it's signed. But when you give poor people money, they spend it. What could be better for the economy than to give people money to spend on food and housing and all of that? So I hope we invest more, and it is going to be frightening. And it's good to see the vaccine coming, but I hope everybody out there that has the capacity to support poor people recognizes that they're going to need to do this for quite a while.
So we had a caller earlier. I didn't get to them in time, but they were asking what can they do to support social workers out there. And is that too simple of a question, Morgan Springsteen, or is there something people can do to help you?
Wear your mask, stay home, limit the people that you're interacting with, and support the communities that we're trying to support as well.
Okay. Morgan Springsteen, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Morgan Springsteen is a licensed social worker and care coordinator at the University of Cincinnati Medical Center. Thanks for your time and thanks for your work, Morgan. And also Tom Gregoire, he is the dean of the College of Social Work at Ohio State. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the invitation to be here and for all you do to call attention to important conversations.
We will continue our conversation about social work in the age of the pandemic and the social justice movement that is ongoing. So stay with us. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The pandemic has created more demand for social workers than ever in hospitals and nursing homes with the homeless and increasingly among law enforcement. The social justice reform movement has its own set of demands, but the profession of social work is confronting its own racist past and policies. Still with us, Angelo McClain. He's Chief Executive Officer of the National Association of Social Workers. Joining us is Patricia Lyons. She's president of the Columbus chapter of the National Association of Black Social Workers. Welcome to the show, Patricia.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ann. I appreciate being here.
I guess the first question people might say is, well, why does there need to be a National Association of Black Social Workers? Why that, and what kind of issues are you confronting?
Well, I'll tell you, the one reason why it needs to be one is because when we were being social workers back in 1960s, we were part of the larger group, which was known as social welfare. And as a result of that, African-Americans were occupying those seats. We were trained, educated, just among all of our non-individuals and colleagues of color. But we found that we were not part of the agenda. We were not being utilized. Our research was not making it through. Our points were not being heard, same as we hear today. And so we walked out, our founders walked out in 1969, and we started our own group. And so here we are today, and we are addressing these issues. We are calling attention to these issues, and we are still saying to our larger colleagues, until we deal with the issue of racism and social work, we cannot ask the community to do more than we're willing to take a look at ourselves.
And racism and social work, you're talking about, I just reiterating what you said, is not being heard, not part of the conversation, and not part of coming up with the policies to solve the problems.
Absolutely. It's that in all things. And again, when we begin to look at the history of social work and social welfare, and what does that mean to folks? And we look at how we have been institutionalized and what has been happening with the issue of racism, who is deemed to be the appropriate social worker at times, who was even actually given an opportunity to be educated in the field of social work. Who do we hold up in terms of our history as leaders in social work? You know, we rarely hear people talk about the work of African Americans and contributing to the social work beyond my sister Sora Dorothy I. Hyde, but we don't talk about Mary Church Terrell and all of those early folks, or George Haynes, who was the first person to get a doctorate degree in philanthropy, who actually now that is considered the New York Columbia University School of Social Work. So again, when our history is missing from the books and from the colleges in the academia world, then how then can we as social workers begin to say, well, we don't need this? Until these things happen, Black social work has a presence, has a purpose, and must continue to move forward. And so thank you for asking that question.
Of course. Since the 1960s, so then since the National Association of Black Social Workers came to be, what have you seen accomplished that is a reflection of that?
Well, here's what I see accomplished. Right now, I see that we have proud social workers who are of African American and color descent who are capable of doing this work. I hear this conversation we're having today is because we have continued to forge the issue of saying, where are we represented? What is happening in our communities? We don't need someone to fix it for us. We need to be at that table to be part of that solution. We're asking when these concepts are coming up, when trauma-informed is coming up, cultural competency, who's deeming the cultural logic of that issue and who is deeming the appropriateness of it? When we don't open the books up in social work schools and see in the history of social work, there's this impetus that happened in social welfare where African-American social workers walked out and created their own piece. If you have that much history, such significant history missing, then there's no way we can ignore that. And so what we're seeing is this continual process. There is no different. We're not saying that others are not fighting for the same cause, but we're always saying very clearly that it is very important that we understand that African-American people belong at this table. We are no longer in a position of where we're trying to have someone declare us capable of doing something we know that we're capable of doing. And we have the same education and want the same opportunity and the same just cause.
Angela McLean, I can't help but think anyone would see the National Association of Black Social Workers as an asset, to the profession in a larger sense.
Absolutely. And I'm so proud that we have the National Association of Black Social Workers. I'm so proud they had the courage back in 68 to walk out and then had the sustainable stamina to keep going. It's 52, 53 years later. And that just, you know, just, yes. The Association of Black Social Workers can articulate something much, much better than NASW can. So we need that viewpoint. And oftentimes there's a perspective there that we may not necessarily bring with the same kind of forcefulness that's needed. And in the last 9 months, that's never been more clear than we do need the National Association of Black Social Workers.
If I live long enough, I can't wait to look back 20 years from now and at this period of time and how things changed going forward. But Patricia Lyons, I mean, Angela McClain mentioned earlier, I think it was you, Angelo, what we all saw on that video when George Floyd was being killed, murdered by a police officer, hoped that it wasn't just another Groundhog Day.
Yes.
And I'm wondering from where you sit, Patricia, what are the ramifications of that? You know, we're still grappling with that in Columbus every day. Two more deaths at the hands of law enforcement in the last month of African-American males unarmed. What is your sense about it?
Well, you know, Anne, one of the things that is very keen to African Americans, to us and people of color, is that this didn't just start then, right? So
right.
We have been living this real lived experience every day.
Right.
You know, we have to teach our kids about driving while Black, walking while Black, wearing a piece of clothing, a hoodie while Black, where no one else really has to talk about that or have that sense of concernment. And when we talk, even in our profession, when we talk to our colleagues, you know, what happens when I say to you, I'm experiencing these things, and you say, well, hey, Pat, you know, I feel so bad. you know, my value of that relationship cannot be the issue for us not continuing that dialogue. And that's what we have seen happen. And so for other folks, this is a aha moment since Mr. Floyd was killed, you know, but the reality is for African-Americans, for people of color, for my indigenous brothers and sisters, this is just a continual perpetuation. This time we didn't have to be told, well, we don't really know what happened or we didn't see what happened. But even when seeing it, it is still amazing to us that there's so much diversity in understanding what actually happened. How do we ask ourselves that we didn't see what we saw? How do you unsee something? And so again, when we continue to see these things, the brothers that we've lost here in Columbus, you know, the travesty of justice that continues to go on and we have to keep coming to the forefront. Are we tired? Absolutely. But we have to keep bringing this up. And so from a National Association of Black Social Work, it is important that we have the folks understand that, listen, this didn't start yesterday. And so until we're really ready to peel back all of the onion layers, we can't talk about change until we talk about the process and what happened and how we're going to do it. What is going to change? I don't need people holding signs up. That's really good. We don't need the hashtag. Even position statements are great. But at the end of the day, what we really need to do is dismantle those policies that got us where we are. Because when we don't have people using their ignorant behavior, and when we don't have those kinds of things happening, and unfortunately, we have all of these policies and processes that create this whole institutional built racism that takes place. And so it's governed and garnered by law. It's governed and garnered by policy. And so instead of saying good intentions, bad policy, let's do it again. We say, well, let's just move forward. And so let's put a Pat Lyons in front, right, so to speak. Let's put an Angelo in front, so to speak, and make that a diverse group. And it's like, that's not the answer. But right. We are here to say we're going to keep pushing it. I am a take a place. So that's where we are. And thank you for that.
Yeah, I wonder about, you know, the two episodes in Columbus, one with a Franklin County Sheriff's deputy and the other with a Columbus police officer who has been terminated. But that's still in play, we know, because of the police union. You know, I'm thinking about, okay, what if a social worker, maybe a social worker of color even, had been embedded or whatever with a police officer in that kind of a situation? I mean, what are your thoughts, Patricia, about that whole big kind of, it's real out front policy change people are talking about, but I'm wondering, what does that even mean in real life?
Mm-hmm. Well, I will tell you, the first thing I would say is, what if that police officer is pointing a gun at my Black social work self trying to render help to someone?
Okay.
You know, so the reality is,
then that's happened.
Right. Exactly. We know it's happening. So putting a social worker out there isn't the answer. The answer is, why is it that our law enforcement are responding this way? That's the question that no one's really asking. And so, yes, am I for social workers being engaged in all across the levels? Absolutely. But individuals have got to be held accountable. Systems got to be held accountable. What are we training our law enforcement officers to do? Since we do know the history of law enforcement came out of slave enforcement. So let's begin there and talk about that, where nobody really wants to talk about that. And so it really does become, you know, you can't move forward unless you take a look back and figure out, how did we get here? And let's do something with that piece. Because again, there are two separate worlds that are converging on one. And social workers are not the discipline just to be plucked out of anything and just thrown everywhere without any regard to all of the other issues that must be addressed.
And likewise, I mean, Angela McLean, the point that Patricia made about police, I mean, I wonder about police culture. All the time, and how it would really embrace that kind of engagement anyway, such as it is, and the way it is the training only on the side of the social workers, or is there more to do on the side of law enforcement too?
There's more to do on both sides. You know, really social work is the profession of working in health settings. You know, we work in schools, hospitals, mental health. We're and oftentimes we're the one or the handful on a team. So we know how to work in teams. We know how to work in host settings. And if we were in police departments or in public safety, that's just another host setting. We could bring our skills to that and we could help change that culture. Now the culture has to be accepting. What we find in most host settings, once we get there, you know, we're the most valuable member on the team. You know, it's whether it's, you know, doing a good discharge planning in a hospital setting, whether it's really helping a child who's struggling academically and their family so that child can make that academic process, or whether it's, you know, being that second responder, you know, in a public safety issue where, you know, the person doesn't have to go to jail, but we can find them a mental health solution or a social service solution. So I think to the extent we are in those settings, you know, we're naturally going to change those settings. But as I said earlier, that we're there not taking orders from the police. We're there as equal partners working solutions for the community.
A one step forward, two step back question, Patricia and Angela McClain. But I think Patricia is probably more familiar with the fact that the Ohio General Assembly did not pass a bill that everybody thought was going to go through, which would reduce to misdemeanors low-level drug offenses. Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, or whatever it's called, opposed the bill because they said it would take away an incentive for people to go into treatment and so on by reducing the penalty. Patricia Lyons, that to me is something right at the ground level that is a problem that everybody agreed was a problem, but it goes unchanged.
That's exactly right. And this is one of the reasons why, because when you look at the world through that lens, when you look at the world through, well, we don't want to do this because people may do that. When you have that negative lens already built in, then nothing's going to change that. And so until we dismantle those kinds of things, those culturological pieces that people bring in, then it does us no good. We move the needle nowhere. It's just conversation. When we can't begin to look at people as human beings across the board, you know, I am a human being. I am a Black woman. I am a social worker. I'm a doctorate of public health, but I'm all those things. And it's important that when someone sees me, that they see me and treat me with respect, regardless of what it is that the assumptions are. And that's what's not happening. That is clearly what's not happening. And as African-American clinician, as a doctorate of social public health, a social worker, rehabilitation counselor, as a sister in the neighborhood, it has gone on too far and we cannot continue to allow this. So I appreciate you for having us on. But these are the conversations we must continue to have. People have to get uncomfortable before they change.
Right. I mean, someone was talking about they just felt like it doesn't have to be a conversation, or can I just sit and listen to you for hour upon hour, Patricia and also Angela McClain, but talk about it, because I'm not sure a conversation necessarily, it's got to be a willingness to want to learn too, right?
Absolutely. You know, and one of the things that I'm always saying, you know, when people create policies and they create these laws, they assume that there's this level of accountability. And I always tell folks that, you know, you can't hold someone accountable unless they allow you to. It is a permissible relationship that must be exchanged between two people, two groups, two segments, or all you're doing is creating structurally enforcement kinds of things which end up being negative in its consequences. And so, you know, coming on your radio station, I allow the public to hold me accountable for what it is that I'm saying that we're trying to do. That's more than just words. And in order to do that, part of that is the conversation that takes place. But also I have to have the public say that I can hold them accountable too. When we have neighbors calling, when the question was asked earlier about child welfare, the reality is, what can you do? Here's what you can do. Be a neighbor. Instead of making the call, how about knock on the door and ask? How about talking to each other? How about assuming innocence in what you're seeing, or checking yourself before you even engage and saying, what is it that I'm feeling about this before I do that? And so we have to start there. We have to, you know, when I look at people, I see you, and I can socially assign you as a Caucasian female. I don't know that you identify that way. But what we do know is that for Black and brown people, that is how the world identify us, regardless of that. And so no matter where I go, what my academic setting is, what my environment is, what my income is, when people see Pat Lyons, they clearly see a Black woman. Whatever it is that they have in their purview as how they view Black women, it all comes with them when they see me. And if that stuff is filled with negativity, if that stuff is filled with hatred, with ugly, bigotry, all of the isms, sexism, then that's how they're going to respond to me. And unfortunately, people aren't comfortable checking themselves at that level.
Well, Patricia Lyons, president of the Columbus chapter of the National Association of Black Social Workers, thank you so much for your time today. I hope you'll come back.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Angela McLean, CEO of the National Association of Social Workers, thanks for your time as well today. I hope you come back.
Thank you. Thank you, Anne, for focusing on this. We really appreciate you doing that.
That's it. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.